Welcome to episode 6 of the Life of a Fighter podcast. I'm Anthony DeFranco, here with James Dalton, our MMA expert, and Mike Kahlo, our resident MMA fighter. We're going to talk about a lot of interesting stuff this week. We got the last fight card of 2011. We have some exciting news for the UFC coming up in 2012. But guys, I don't think there's any doubt that we have to start with what people were arguably saying was the biggest fight card of 2011. Brock Lesnar versus Alistair Overeem is the main event. And in that main event, I think what a lot of MMA purists thought was going to happen happened. Alistair Overeem absolutely runs over Brock Lesnar in the first round. What did you guys think of this fight, and particularly the performance of Brock Lesnar?
I thought it was great, and I actually have to disagree with you. I think a lot of MMA purists actually, I had written an article about it. They were acting as though Brock Lesnar was certain to win, and as my article stated, Overeem won it, and Brock Lesnar, I think, definitely did not look like he used to look. I think the last time we saw Brock Lesnar look good was back in July of, 2009, UFC 100. Since then, I don't think we're ever going to see Brock Lesnar look like he looked again. I don't think anybody who gets diverticulitis is going to look like they had before that, affects them. So, but Overeem looked great though, and it was exciting to see him look the way he looked. He really looked very predatory, and it was good.
Yeah, I was surprised too, actually, by all the people that were thinking Lesnar was really going to take this one. I think that if you really are an MMA purist, as Anthony said it, that you should have had Overeem in that one. It just makes sense. He's a better striker. And honestly, if you look at his history, you could argue he's a better grappler. So I really didn't see how people could think Lesnar was going to win that fight, but a lot of even fighter friends of mine said that they saw Lesnar winning that fight. But great fight. I was kind of surprised that Lesnar didn't try and pursue the takedown a little bit more.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think that was the obvious strategy for Lesnar to win that fight, was to grab a single leg, grab a double leg, to then attempt to get it to the ground and try to beat up Overeem when he was on the ground. He made one kind of, you don't want to call it half-hearted, because obviously you're not inside Brock Lesnar's head, but kind of half-hearted attempt at a takedown, and that was pretty much his entire, offense, and there really wasn't much else from Brock Lesnar. I think that people who thought Overeem might lose this fight get kind of crowded up in the, well, it was Strikeforce, and who did he really fight? And then there's the steroid scandals, and I don't think it's a kind of a cool thing to do to pick Alistair Overeem because of that, because there's so much else going on. But I think, to be honest, it's like James said, we haven't seen a really good Brock Lesnar in a long time. And part of it is probably the diverticulitis, but I think part of it is also that this is a guy who historically quits on pursuits. He quit on the WWE, he quit on attempting to get into football, and I think that it's getting to the point where he kind of got tired of MMA, and he got tired of the grind, and I think that that has something to do with it too.
That's an interesting point, actually.
He kind of hasn't really finished anything in his life, and he's, don't get me wrong, he's a huge draw, he makes everybody lots of money, but I just don't know how seriously we could take Brock Lesnar the anything. If he was to say, well, I'm going to be a professional bass fisherman tomorrow, I'd say check in with me again in 3 years and see if you're still a bass fisherman. Because that just seems to be the way that guy does business. Who leaves their phone on during a podcast?
It's my aunt, too. It's important. Hold on.
Let's get back to the fight, though. Let's talk about now the matchup that's going to be coming with Alistair Overeem and Junior Dos Santos. This is a really good MMA purist's fight. Two strikers, two guys who want to keep it on the feet, a boxer versus a kickboxer.
Oh, yeah.
What do we think?
Overeem. People are saying, oh, JDS, his boxing is going to, he's going to get inside. His boxing is technically more sound than, Overeem's. I hope I didn't just say Overeem's boxing is more sound than... I meant JDS's boxing's technically more sound than Overeem's. But they're being absolutely ridiculous. First of all, Overeem has at least 20 more pounds of just pure muscle on Junior Dos Santos. Junior Dos Santos is coming off of a surgery on his knee. never a good thing, you know. So it's gonna probably take away some of his speed. And at the end of the day, you know, JDS is a little bit of a one-trick pony, and that trick is boxing. It's striking. That's not something that Alistair Overeem is afraid of. When's the last time that Alistair Overeem was knocked out? I really don't know.
Shogun Hua? No, that wasn't a knockout. Wasn't that a TKO?
If anything, it was on the ground, right? Ground and pound?
Yeah.
I don't see Junior Dos Santos, you know, using grappling to overpower Junior Overeem. And, yeah. Right? You know what I'm saying? That was Shogun, you know.
It was a different weight class, too, but, like, that was when he was still lighter.
Right.
I mean, like you're saying, Junior Dos Santos definitely has the more technical hands, but...
Well, let's put it this way. You want to talk striking? How many times do you see people end fights with liver kicks?
Boss Rutten?
Yeah, right. I mean...
And but we're talking about...
In K1, I mean, I think it's a little bit more frequent.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even look at, whatchamacallit? All right, this is a bad example. I'm just... Random one is Pete Sell with a body shot that
right.
Even though he got ended up knocking out because he rushed in, but it can be very, very paralyzing.
Right, like, right. But my point is, that is striking.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
Though that is the ultimate knowledge of your opponent, their weak points, and the accuracy to hit them.
Okay, with your accuracy of kicks, I get you.
And that is what Alistair Overeem has.
The last time Alistair Overeem was knocked out was Sergei Karatanov at Heroes 10 on September 17th, 2007.
Was that also his last loss?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, okay. It was.
Yeah.
And then before that was Hua. I'm going to agree with you guys. I think Overeem's going to win this fight. I think that we talk about the toolbox a lot. Mm-hmm. And when you have a boxer versus a kickboxer, and two guys who do almost exclusively those two things, the kickboxer's toolbox is fuller. I mean, I think that's pretty much what it comes down to. Is it a little scary for the UFC to potentially have Alistair Overeem as your heavyweight champion?
No, not at all. I think it's great.
Well, he's got all this
homegrown.
No, but he's got all this kind of baggage, and there's always kind of this shroud of mystery and
steroids.
The steroids and the thing with the Nevada State Athletic Commission and
they like Chael Sonnen. They just gave him his own...
I guess that's true.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, UFC, it is a company at the end of the day, right? It's about
making money.
But at the same time, you have to think, all right, how does image affect making money?
Well, the UFC has been so protective of its image. And we're going to talk more about something about this later. But they've been so almost bloodhoundy-ish about protecting the image of the sport as pure and not associated with pro wrestling and not associated with Japan and not associated with all these things, that now when they've kind of lightened up on that, it almost feels strange, I think. It feels almost like they're letting it go. And I think to some people, that's a scary concept. Speaking of letting it go, let's talk about Brock Lesnar and his post-fight interview, effectively retiring from MMA after his very short run. What did you guys think of that as far as... Obviously, your first thought is, wow, that just cost the UFC a lot of money. Because he's still their biggest pay-per-view draw. But what do you guys think about Lesnar retiring, coming out the way he has in his last few fights?
You know something? I think it's good for him. I don't think he's ever going to be the same fighter he was again. And, you know, as far as implications, though, on the weight class, though, I think that, I think it's really good for Frank Mir. Because I really do think that he is Frank Mir's kryptonite. So...
Yeah, that he is.
I really do. So, especially with where Mir is right now in the weight class, I think that this could allow... Mir to kind of end up with like a number one contender spot, maybe fighting like an Overeem for the title. So,
but there is also almost like an exact copy or replica of Lesnar and Shane Carwin. I mean, maybe all right, he's a little bit smaller.
Not
now.
As athletic.
Yeah, he's a little bit smaller.
And I'm telling you, since Carwin no longer is getting any doctor's notes,
no longer altering his body chemistry,
he coincidentally just lost, you know, 30 pounds by changing his diet.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's.
And he's also. Well, again, I think you bring up an interesting point, because when Lesnar and Carwin were at their peaks, we were talking about the evolution of the heavyweight, the 265-pound super wrestler, the guy who could just literally ground everyone into submission. It kind of never happened like everyone thought it would. And now all of a sudden, you have a position where Frank Mir, historically at his worst when he's being pushed around, pushed back into the cage, a guy like that suddenly doesn't have to worry about that with a guy like Overeem or JDS. And yes, you still have Cain Velasquez, but Cain Velasquez isn't 265 pounds.
Yeah, he's a little undersized.
So, you know, as far
Shane
as...
Shane Carwin is maybe smaller than Cain Velasquez now.
Yeah, but that's why, now that I think about it, size-wise, it's not even the same comparison. That's
right, exactly. So we kind of never saw that guy that we thought we were going to start seeing carbon copies of Lesnar.
Exactly.
There really weren't any of them, including Lesnar himself, you know, after the sickness. Do you... I mean, this is just a personal thought, but this division's always been super top-heavy. You know, you have five or six really interesting fighters, then after that it's kind of a mishmash of mediocrity. Does losing Brock Lesnar, A, obviously it hurts them in the wallet, B, does it kind of take some of the luster away from the heavyweight division now? Because now there really aren't a lot of guys who are casual draws.
Well, there will be when the Strikeforce guys come in.
Yeah, that's one angle. But even I really think when we talk about a purist, an MMA purist, I know that Lesnar has big fans, but me as an MMA fighter and fan, I don't like Lesnar as where people put him as an all-around fighter. I think he was a wrestler that was huge. He just dwarfed everybody in the heavyweight division at the time when he first exploded on, and now he's getting exposed regardless of surgery. Even when he fought Shane Carwin wasn't that threatening of a full mixed martial arts fighter. There's not a lot of many mixed martial arts heavyweights. Overeem, Junior Dos Santos, they still got to get bigger, though, to be compared. Overeem, not so much. But Overeem's a real example of a full mixed
martial arts fighter. If Overeem gets bigger, his head might actually just explode.
Yeah, then that's...
His head could actually use a little bit more size.
That's true. He does look kind of small. So going through to this... upcoming year, do we see Alistair Overeem taking the belt, holding on to it, kind of taking a monopoly on it, like we see someone like Jon Jones doing?
Oh, yeah.
You don't think there's anyone out there who could beat him right now?
I mean, I want to see how he does against Dos Santos first. Like, I really do want to see how that goes, because I do think the only chance, or I don't think that it's going to be completely lopsided, to be honest with you. I think Junior Dos Santos, if he can use his hands, I mean...
Well, you know, the other thing that I thought was interesting that people started bringing up was the idea of the clinch, is that if you close distance on a kickboxer, a lot of times it's difficult for them to kind of get off. I don't know if that's going to work because of the size difference.
Yeah, and Overeem, he has some just brutal knees.
Did you see Overeem just walk up to Brock? And if you rewatch that fight, he just walks up to Brock, this wrestler, and he just, like, walks up to him and hugs him. And he's like, hey, and he just knees him.
Yeah.
You know. So, you know, Overeem is not afraid of clinching with anybody. He's a talented fighter, you know. So he's not concerned about people closing distance with him.
My actual viewpoint on this is I completely agree. I think he is very talented, especially at heavyweight. My only fear is that at heavyweight, this is where you will kind of see it, I think, a lot in the future too, is are you sacrificing a speed? Like, Junior Dos Santos was supposedly the best combination of that hybrid fighter of where he can be powerful, because he's got power in his hands. Like,
yeah.
I think if he connects, he can knock Overeem out. I don't see that really being a problem on a clean, maybe a hook or a nice overhand, right? I think that the speed is something that... Overeem's got power. And when I say speed, I don't mean speed with one punch. I mean speed when you try and throw four, five, six punches.
Right.
And putting it together. But Overeem, he can throw one, two punches, throw a knee, throw a switch kick, and put you on your ass. So I don't know. I'm intrigued to see how Overeem does against Dos Santos to see what happens.
Do you think Junior Dos Santos hits harder than Badou Hardy?
I don't know.
But isn't it different? Isn't it different in the sense that isn't that K1? And
well. I mean, still, MMA still, gloves, you can do
yeah,
more.
I mean, I think that's kind of this.
You can do more damage, but in theory, you don't think that Badou Hardy could hit harder even with K1 gloves on?
I don't think you can make the comparison because of the difference in the gloves. I think the difference in the gloves is I mean, again, I've this is going to sound like I'm a degenerate, but I've been hit with training with whatever the K1 gloves are, and then I've been hit with MMA gloves, and it's different. It's different. I think you can attest to the same thing.
Yeah, it's completely like I honestly would, with 16-ounce sparring gloves, even though let's say the 12-ounce or I think it's 10-ounce
in K1, I think it's 10-ounce.
Yeah, it's and even still, like they're. It's like a shell around your hand, and then once you go to the MMA gloves, it's a completely different ballgame. Yeah. Like, you can really hurt someone with that.
Right. I mean, I got hit by the same guy with the 12 or 10-ounce gloves, and then I got hit with the MMA gloves, and it was vastly different. It was vastly different. It's I think that there are guys, obviously, in the heavyweight division that depend on that, depend on the 4-ounce glove, like Junior Dos Santos, who's going to win most of his fights by knockout. And I just think it's very different. Ultimately, I'm still going to take Overeem, but I don't want to sit here and say that he's going to now monopolize this division and that we have another dominant champion on our hands. I don't know if he's that guy.
Who beats Overeem?
Well, that's the thing. I think we really have to look at how he beats Dos Santos, if he beats Dos Santos, which I think...
If he runs through Dos Santos, you'll be hard-pressed.
Well, Overeem runs through Dos Santos. I think... You know who gives Overeem the biggest challenge?
Velasquez.
Yes. Velasquez. Yeah.
I agree. And I think Cain Velasquez can be back on the mountaintop by you know, this time next year. I don't think there's any question.
And after Velasquez, Daniel Cormier.
Daniel Cormier is one of the funniest, like, I have such a hard time buying him, because if you look at him, looks like a fat guy. Like a big fat guy.
Yeah,
but he's so talented as a wrestler, and obviously, you know, it's appearances are deceiving. But again, I think he still needs to work on his striking a lot, and... He's not complete.
Right hand. Well, I mean, you could say
the Dan Henderson. Yeah.
You could say Dan Henderson.
But I hate guys who rely on that.
Yeah.
I would much rather have a well balanced guy than a guy who relies on his wrestling and his one big right hand.
Yeah. If it works, that's fine. Keep it and use that as one of your weapons. But why not develop other weapons? You know,
It's like a wide receiver saying, well, I have big hands that I can catch, so I'm not going to work on getting faster.
Exactly.
It doesn't make sense to me. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about the rest of this card. A really impressive performance from Nate Diaz, still to talk about. And we're also going to talk in the third segment about the UFC's deal with Fox and now the programming coming up on Fuel and how that's going to affect the growing popularity of MMA and the UFC. All that and more still coming up. You're listening to the Life of a Fighter podcast.
Is your New Year's resolution to lose weight, build muscle, have more energy? Then don't wait and come down to Carlo MMA. At Carlo MMA, we have classes that include everything from cardio kickboxing, self-defense, grappling classes, to striking classes for MMA, and even nutrition consultation. We also offer private and group sessions for more personal attention and instruction. It's not about being a better fighter, it's about building a better you. Classes run from 7 to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday, and Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. You can find more info at MikeCaulo.com. That's Mike, M-I-K-E, Caulo, C-A-U-L-O.com.
Welcome back to the Life of a Fighter podcast. Anthony DeFranco here with James Dalton, MMA analyst, Mike Caulo, MMA fighter, talking about UFC 141. First segment, we talked a lot about Brock Lesnar, Alistair Overeem. Now let's talk about the rest of this fight card. Let's start with Vladimir Matoshenko, kind of the resident 205 gatekeeper, going up against Alexander Gustafsson. This was a fight I was interested in because I'm always interested when Gustafsson fights. He's one of those guys who I, for whatever reason, like to think is going to be the future of that division, even if he's not. What were you guys' thoughts on this fight? Gustafsson ultimately winning via TKO 235 of round one.
Well, first of all, thank you, Vlad Matyushenko, for my Hayabusa shorts. But I'm sorry that...
Wait, what?
Wait, hold on.
Yeah, I won Hayabusa shorts from Vlad Matyushenko a few months ago from a Twitter contest. But
Vlad Matyushenko, all-around good guy.
Yeah. But, you should probably retire.
It's about that time.
Yeah, Gustafsson... I didn't know this, but apparently one of his nicknames is the White John Jones. But I kind of made that same inference. Yeah, he looks good. He doesn't look I mean, he looks good, but he's not that amazing. You know, he doesn't give you that. He doesn't have that same flair about him.
Yeah, he's not as flashy.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. He's like a more technical John Jones. He's more reserved.
Oh,
he's not
horrible.
Looking too.
Why would you want to see that?
No, yeah, and yeah, I was just gonna say the same thing. I mean, I'll give you a great example of that. I'm a huge Uriah Faber fan. I've liked him since the WEC. When he got knocked out by Mike Brown, my first thought was like, I knew that was going to come eventually. Because someone's going to catch you when you start spinning and doing things like that. And John Jones hasn't been caught yet, obviously, and may never be caught because he's so good. But I always like the technical guy over the flashy guy. Gustafson... aren't very many prospects at 205. We're kind of like we have Phil Davis, but they're kind of pushing him into, for lack of a better term, the main eventing kind of role now.
Yeah.
Gustafson at 205 is kind of one of the last intriguing young guys.
He's the last hope right now.
I mean, really, maybe? I mean, because again, we're always talking about who can beat John Jones. Just keep Gustafson in mind for the next time he fights. Let's go on to probably the biggest surprise of the night. John Fitch making his long-awaited return that didn't last very long. He was knocked out via punch 12 seconds of round one. I know that I'm alone on this one, but I love John Fitch. I've loved John Fitch for a long time. I also love GSP, and it's kind of a similar fight to win rather than fight to be flashy kind of mentality. But Johnny Hendricks shooting up the ladder after this one, or are we just John Fitch not being where we thought he was?
I think that honestly, regardless of where John Fitch is and regardless of how skilled he really is and what it looks like, I think that kind of a win, that kind of a knockout, that gives you momentum. That does skyrocket you. We will find out and see, you know, how legitimate it really is, because I really think if that fight happened 100 times, that's a 1 in 100 kind of shot. I really don't see Johnny Hendricks landing that high percentage of the time. That's just... I think a low percentage just kind of happened.
Johnny Hendricks lost to somebody. Who was it? Like Mike Pierce or something? It's not like he's been like on an undefeated streak. I mean, he was, but then he did have a loss like within his past five fights. So, you know, him saying that he wants a title shot's a little premature.
I mean, I don't think he should get a title shot. He lost to Rick Story.
Okay, there we go.
You know, here's the thing. He was 9-0. He was 9-0,
right?
And then he lost to Rick Story. He then beat TJ Waldbarger, beat Mike Pierce in a split decision that I thought he might have lost, and then beat John Fitch.
Uh-huh.
He's got an impressive resume. I just think he's maybe one or two fights away from being really considered for any kind of title shot or anything like that.
Right.
But he's got great wrestling. Mm-hmm. He's got a bullhouse punch. And, you know, he's got some tools, and I think in a division starving for contenders, like we say all the time, he's a name to watch, again.
Right. I'm very glad he beat John Fitch, by the way, because I can't stand John Fitch's whole deal.
What his style of approach?
Well, John Fitch, I have an interesting... John Fitch just... Anyway. Yeah, his style, his way he goes about things, his attitude about his style.
I just think we might be seeing the kind of beginning of the downslope of John Fitch in the sense that he was 1A for so long, and everyone's like, this is the best guy not named George St. Pierre. And I think we're starting to see that, it's scary to say, but that generation of fighter start to fade out a little bit.
How old is John Fitch, actually?
I could tell you in a second, but...
109.
I mean, I don't think he's young.
So in the
meantime, tell you that. 1978, which makes him 30, coming up on 33.
So he's right about that.
And he's been fighting for a while, which also, you know, obviously we talk about fight years. Mm-hmm. You know, that's it's not exactly that he's
young.
He's not exactly super young, you know. So you think about a guy like Vanderlei Silva, who's not that old when you look at the actual number of years, but
when you look at his face,
right? You know, you can kind of tell this guy's been in a few wars. And there's a difference, obviously, and then you look at guys who are 35 and have five MMA fights and don't fight like they're 35.
Exactly.
So, you know, there is something to being in a lot of fights. I think we're going to see John Fitch come back. He'll probably get a softball, you know, probably to get him back.
That was Johnny Hendricks.
I don't think Johnny Hendricks is a softball. Dude was 11-1 and had legit wins.
I think that's what he was supposed to be for John Fitch, who takes out top contenders.
Nah, I don't know about that. I don't think Johnny Hendricks is a softball. He's 11-1.
Do you think that they expected
I think they expected him to win, but I don't think that they thought if he doesn't win this fight, John Fitch is in trouble. I think that's the difference.
This is the first sign of trouble for John.
And not only that, but we talk about it all the time. When you're away from the cage for that long, ring rust is a real thing.
No, it definitely is. I mean, I really think, like, even touching on the age thing, 35 in my mind is that hump that there's two ways to go about it. You either start to completely drop off or you're going to deteriorate at some point. Like, even Anderson Silva, you can't argue he's quote-unquote dropped off.
Right.
But you can kind of, if you look at his fights post-35 and before 35, let's make a little bit comparison.
Well, he stopped dancing.
Yeah. Well, not even, I mean, which honestly, believe it or not, that dancing, it implements a lot about your footwork, your strategy, your in and out, your movement. It's very important to a striker's game.
Your love life.
Yeah, I mean, that even too. You know, I'm sure you get
the other thing that you touched on that I just want to say real quick about John Fitch is, I think we need to get this concept of a knockout being the most dominant form of victory out of people's heads. Like you said, you go through that fight 100 times, that happens maybe once. You know, and I think sometimes a grinded out 3-round decision is more impressive than the 12-second knockout.
If you know what to look for, I think. Like you know, and also depends on the kind of grind out. If it's just a takedown and you're laying.
Oh, no, yeah, obviously, obviously. But if you're doing damage.
Yeah,
and if you really dominate a fight, I think that to me is always going to be more impressive than going in 12 seconds in, you hit a guy with a shot in the temple, and he goes down.
Because that could happen to anybody.
Like that, right.
You know, I mean,
Great example. What was a more impressive fight? Shogun versus Machida 1 or Shogun versus Machida 2 for Shogun? In my opinion, Shogun versus Machida 1. Because I think he dominated that fight, and he should have won that fight. And then I think you have the knockout, which is a temple punch.
The exciting thing about the knockout is that it's a climax. You know, people don't like things going to the judges.
Oh, no, I agree. Yeah. I'm not saying you shouldn't attempt to finish fights.
Yeah.
But I say when you're grading performance, I think that this fight is an incomplete for John Fitch rather than being an F,
yeah.
You know, for getting dominated. If he was getting dominated on the feet for 2.5 rounds and then got knocked out, or even for a round and then got knocked out, that's an F.
Well, why did he let a guy punch him? Why did he let a guy knock him out with a left hook?
It's not a matter of like, dude,
yeah,
right here. You know, it's a matter of, you know, a shot got through.
He kind of walked up to him with his hands down.
Yeah, that was another thing I actually saw. I'm like, his right hand is pretty low, which was upsetting to see, but maybe he was anticipating more of a wrestling match.
Yeah.
You know, he might have trained a lot of wrestling for this, bringing your hands.
There you go.
So, I don't know.
Last but not least, we have probably a guy I never like to admit when he does well, but Nate Diaz coming out probably, I would say, the best performance of his career against a very game opponent in Donald Cerrone. Cerrone has really been on a good roll recently, and he got dominated.
Yeah.
And a unanimous decision victory for Nate Diaz. Where does Nate Diaz stand in that very crowded lightweight division now?
I mean, first let's even say a 3-round fight
right. Can
be more impressive sometimes than a knockout. I think that 3-round fight with Nate Diaz was the most impressive performance I think I've ever seen of his.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of both him and his brother Nick's hands. They have great hands. I really thought Cerrone was going to take that fight. So
I did too.
I mean, that puts him, like, you know, right up there. And my only concern is what is his strength looking like at 155? But he cuts weight because he sucks a lot of weight out. Like,
yeah.
And I've seen in reading a lot of articles, and if you hear in interviews, he says it affects him. That's why he went up to 170. So, I mean, just but based on pure performance, though, alone, obviously the best performance he's put out. And who's he going to fight now? Like, you know, that's the question, right?
Yeah, there was two interesting factors about that fight. For one, Nate Diaz set the CompuStrike record. Previously set by his brother in his fight against BJ, I believe. So he landed like something like 83% of his punches. Two, though, you know, for such an impressive performance, I'm not saying it wasn't impressive, you know, but also there was a lot of flaws, you know, the fact that
for
Diaz, okay. You know, Cerrone kept on sweeping his leg out right from under him,
yeah.
You know, and I think the only reason Cerrone didn't take advantage of that was that Diaz's, you know, right, his jiu-jitsu. You know, but when you're in a fight like that, you shouldn't be continually brought down to the ground by leg kicks. So, you know, that's something that.
Maybe he can go to the drawing board. That's what he's got to work on, leg kicks. Then that's what that says to me. Because
seems like he tends to like be very apprehensive with his leg checks.
Exactly. That's something that even like, you know, when you go into Muay Thai class or when you take any kind of stand up class or something that I'll even teach to students, that's really we emphasize is when you check a kick, you have to go after that kick. You have to, once you read that kick is coming, you have to be able to initially hit that check. Otherwise, you saw what happened to Diaz. That check's going to go through a good kickboxer, a Muay Thai fighter is going to kick through your front leg and chop your second leg out, and you're going to fall to the ground. And in a kickboxing fight, that's points. And in this, let's say, you know, his submissions weren't that good, he would have been in a lot of trouble. You know, maybe if it was a wrestler. I'm trying to think a wrestler was good at 55.
So many of them. Edgar, Guida. Maynard, Guida.
Yeah, let's even say with they put
Diego
a nice...
Diego Sanchez?
I'm even thinking with a good combo of kicks there that can go through.
Ben Henderson? Ben Henderson, athletic. Throws some good kicks.
Has, you know, a Taekwondo background that developed into a Muay Thai, so his kicks are there. So even Ben Henderson, that would be the perfect stylistic matchup, I think, that would give him problems again, where trip out his leg, try and jump on him. But then does that fall right into where Nate wants to fight? Submissions.
I think that's the way to beat him. I think when you look at the high-level wrestlers at 155, Maynard, Edgar, Henderson, those guys, specifically Henderson, because we've seen he cannot be killed by conventional weapons in the fights against Cerrone, I think that's a really awful matchup for Nate Diaz, because that's a guy who refuses to go out, and the jiu-jitsu, and not only that, but I think Ben Henderson is still getting better, which is really, and again, the athletics are really there with him, too.
What about Pettis versus Diaz?
Ooh, okay, yeah, even that.
I think Diaz would win that fight. Even I like Anthony Pettis and I want him to do well, but I think that he's going to be making a living on the cage kick for a while.
And he misses the wrestling needed to really, I guess, pressure Diaz.
I think he's the kind of guy who might be able to get Diaz down, but then he becomes really vulnerable in Diaz's guard.
Exactly. He needs a little bit better, I guess, strength or wrestling to put it together. But
and that Duke Rufus camp up there, there aren't many of them that really have that great wrestling background.
What about
it's mostly a bunch of guys who like to stand and throw kicks.
Do you think that he could pick him apart with his striking, especially his kicks?
Because it's very hard to pick apart a Diaz brother because of
that's their game.
That incredibly bizarre striking style where they're coming at you throwing this huge volume of strikes where they aren't necessarily it doesn't look very visually appealing, but at the same time it's just so effective and so abnormal that it's so hard to duplicate in training.
Right.
So I don't think he's ever going to be able to get the kind of space to quote pick him apart, you know, on the feet.
Or be able to apply the pressure. I mean, we've never really, at least I don't really recall any time that Diaz has been really pressured to the point where he couldn't come up with some kind of answer. It's a matter of, can you just take him out of his game enough to put the fight where you want it? And ideally that would be a wrestler putting him on his back and not getting submitted and passing. Or, I mean, in Anthony Pettis' case, maybe that would be, you know, trying to land a head kick. You know, trying to do some kind of damage, but I don't see that, you know.
All right, when we come back, we'll wrap up the show talking about some new ventures for the UFC, specifically the UFC's programming on Fuel, what we thought of it, how we think it's going to grow the sport, and what are the positives and negatives of the shows we saw. You're listening to the Life of a Fighter podcast. Come on back.
Hey, man, all my friends are talking about mixed martial arts, but I don't know enough to be part of the conversation. What can I do?
You know, you should check out lifeofafighter.com. It gives you a unique perspective on the world of mixed martial arts that will make you seem like you've been watching it since the first UFC tournament.
Okay, good idea. But why can't I get them from any other website? Or how about watching sports shows on TV?
Well, Life of a Fighter is actually run by real fighters and experts that actually train in the sport. So when they give you their opinions and perspective, they actually tell you not only why you should know this, but how it applies to the information they're giving you. Stats and highlights don't mean anything if you don't understand why they're important in the first place. They also have information and reviews on nutrition, supplements, products, gear, and more.
Wow, that sounds great. Okay, I'm going to get all my MMA news and info from lifeofafighter.com.
And also, don't forget to follow them on Facebook and Twitter at Life of a Fighter. Life of a Fighter. Some fight to live, we live to fight.
Welcome back to the Life of a Fighter podcast. Anthony DeFranco, James Dalton, Mike Kahlo, here discussing all your UFC news, analysis, and other various hilarity with you. Let's talk about this UFC on Fox deal now. We're starting to really get into full swing with it. We have the UFC on FX card coming up. We have another UFC on Fox card coming up. And perhaps most importantly, we had the beginning of the Fuel TV UFC programming. That obviously started with a very sports center type show that started actually from when we're recording this last night. James, I know you saw it. I know you had some thoughts on it. What was your opinion of that show and how it's going to affect the UFC's expansion into mainstream sport?
Yeah, so I watched the UFC Tonight, or whatever their news show was called. So firstly, that was actually... First of all, I wasn't really expecting much, but I was pleasantly surprised. It was an interesting kind of, very much like a inside MMA type show. A little less professionally done, I'd say. A little bit more of on the versus types kind of style. I'm going to use the word arcadey. You know, it's kind of like a strange word to use when talking about a news program, but everything seemed a little more kind of like Fox-like. But it was interesting, though. Dana White was there, you know, and he was saying that that was always a dream of theirs to get a UFC-run news show to kind of go over everything that had happened during the week. But really the biggest thing about it was the fact that they have control of all of the UFC footage. And if you've ever watched any of the other kind of news shows, you'll always find, especially on a show like Inside MMA on HDNet, they'll be able to show, you know, everything up until like a few seconds to the finish of the fight. They're not allowed to show the end of the fight, which is very frustrating, especially when they're talking about the results of fights. On this show, they, like, for example, repeatedly showed Alistair Overeem delivering the liver kick and then following up with the ground and pound that finished Brock Lesnar, which is very satisfying, especially for a fan that's actually into stuff and you want to be able to follow the conversation and just, you know.
Have visuals, too.
Exactly, because it really legitimizes the sport. It's like a football highlight reel. You're actually talking about what's going on.
Let's. I know this may not sound like a big deal to, you know, if you're Joe Average out there listening, you're saying, oh, well, why is this a big deal? Imagine the following. You're watching SportsCenter. Oklahoma City is playing Dallas. It's a tie game. Kevin Durant lines up to shoot the three to win the game. And seconds before the ball goes in the hoop, they have to cut the video. That's kind of where the UFC is at, or was at, with their concepts of lending out their video library to other outlets. And you see it even on ESPN. Even on ESPN, they don't really show the finishes of fights a lot of the times, which I always thought was really stupid because until recently, that was probably their biggest way to get it, to kind of have casual fans catch the end of a fight on ESPN. Yeah. So I think that obviously is important. Now, what do you guys think about Dana White? This is kind of an interesting thing and that we've never really had before. The president of a company appearing as an analyst for his own company. We saw it on the UFC on Fox card. We saw it again last night on UFC Tonight. Is there an inherent conflict of interest there?
Well, I mean, in all fairness, he wasn't really analyzing too much last night. He was kind of introducing the show. And
but doesn't it put him in a bad situation, for example, what happened with the UFC on Fox when he says that he didn't understand Cain Velasquez's game plan and now he's kind of burying his own fighter?
He said the exact same thing about Brock Lesnar at the post-fight analysis. He said the exact same thing. But you know something?
And in fairness, I agree with him. But doesn't that put him in a very strange situation considering he's the promoter?
He doesn't care.
Well, it's not... Yeah, I think it brings another level to it that can kind of... bring some value, honestly, because you can say, hey, you know what? Even he sees it. I as a fan, even not as a fighter, as a fan, I respect that and I like that. I like the fact that he can say, hey, you know what? These are my fighters, but that was a crappy game plan. And he can say that. Other, you know, let's say even a boxing promoter or the NFL, they're so protective over their athletes, which is, that's smart to an extent. But I think where it's at right now, that helps kind of bring some attraction, bring some fans, bring some momentum into their, you know, entire approach, and it makes it more entertaining TV, at least for right now. Now, I don't know, long term, maybe it might have a problem. How the fighters might go against it, say, hey, listen, you can't, you know, we don't want to fight with you because you're gonna, you know, put us down, you know, but honestly, you'd be surprised how sensitive fighters can be,
of course,
you know. So, there, I think especially with the MMA fighting, it might be an issue. That's an interesting part. I personally like it, though. Mm-hmm. I like to see his perspective, and he's a good analyst. Dana White knows what he's talking about.
I mean, so. I admire it in a business sense, too. You know, I like the fact that he can call bullshit on what happens in his own company, and he's not afraid to. Because you know something? Without Dana White, there is no UFC at this point. So, obviously, he's doing stuff right in some sense. So, just let him keep on doing what he's doing.
Also on that show, there's a segment with everyone's favorite MMA villain, Chael Sonnen. Chael Sonnen doing Chael's Corner. What do you guys think of this? It's an interesting marketing tool. Is it asking for trouble?
I think, yeah. Honestly, like, I think, like, people love it. And I understand it, because it's
again, it's the concept of the pro wrestling promo. Again, it's there is something to hearing a guy who's funny and listening to him talk. But is it asking for trouble from the other fighters?
Yeah, I don't know that it's totally necessary. I mean, it's cute and all, but listen, we all know that Chael's... See, that's one thing. You know, they asked Dana White about Chael, and he kind of just sat there with, like, one of his cute smiles on, and he's like, listen, Chael's kind of...
Chael.
Crazy. Yeah, exactly. And he's like, but, you know, if there's one thing about Chael, he backs up what he says. You know, so they're... You know, there's one thing about it. If Chael beats Mark Munoz, this is a good platform to kind of push him into, like, a super fight with Anderson Silva. But, you know, it is kind of obnoxious to give him this platform on their own kind of UFC show without giving the other fighters a similar platform.
Exactly. So,
not to sound like stick-in-the-mud journalism background guy, but doesn't it hurt the credibility as a legitimate news show and make it sound a lot more like a kind of marketing ploy?
Well, yeah. Having Todd Harris as your, like, anchor...
Okay, anchors man. Suck. Anchors suck all the time, let's be honest. I mean, there are a lot of kind of, excuse my language ahead of time, shitty anchors out there. To have a guy kind of almost making light of your own... Making light of the product in the way that he does, I just don't necessarily think is the most professional thing to go about it. And like I said, it seems like UFC has tried so hard to be that kind of, like... Yeah, we're just like everybody else. We're like the NFL. Start taking us seriously. And then you do things like this that kind of make you scratch your head.
Yeah, it's kind of... Because you almost... This is, like you said before, it's putting them in that WWE perspective.
Right.
And I think that the further they can detach themselves from that kind of a concept, the better. Because...
And they have. They've gone so far out of the way. I mean, we hear stories all the time about Brock Lesnar wanting to go back and do wrestling and... He's like, no, not while you're under contract with us, because then people are going to start seeing us in that same light, and then that's not what I want, you know?
But also, people like the sensationalism in, like, basketball and football, you know? It's not like it doesn't exist there, and they kind of...
I just think you have to curb it, especially in combat sports, because it's so easy to get stuck in that corner.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, again, a little bit more with that concept of sensationalism. We were having a kind of a little bit of argument off air, and it kind of works as a similar marketing concept. Fighters and Twitter. We've seen it now. Twitter is so in your face on television now, whether you're watching a regular hour-long drama or you're watching sports. You see on sports, you see people's Twitter comments popping up. And now in the UFC, obviously, they were very much on the forefront of it with showing people's Twitter names as they come out to their cage. But do we think that Twitter is necessarily the greatest tool for fighters who, let's be honest, Mike, you know this.
Yeah.
You have to be kind of crazy to get punched in the face for a living. Is giving crazy people an outlet the greatest way to market your product?
I think that if you can kind of, I don't want to say control, but kind of guide them in a direction, I think it's a very valuable tool. Like, I notice a lot of even my traffic that goes to the website comes from Twitter and Facebook. A lot of influence can be there. It's a great marketing ploy, but like you said, especially if you're a little bit off or you have a very eccentric personality or something like that that makes you want to fight. You know, like, fighters fight for many reasons. Maybe it's, you know, like they don't like the attention, whatever have you. It could be beneficial, but it could also be very dangerous. Even if you look at the recent comments of, you know, Miguel Torres and, I mean, the Forrest Griffins and their Rashad Evans comments, and, like, it wasn't all on Twitter, but stuff like that is where you have to start to be a little weary. But the UFC itself, they have contractual obligations to their fighters, and they have, you know, agreements where they can't do certain things, or they have to represent the company in a certain manner, or right. there are repercussions. So I think that, I mean, I think it's valuable, to be honest. I think it's an important thing to be able to use. And hey, why not? Let the fighters voice what they want to say. As long as it doesn't hurt the sport, let's hear what we have to say.
All right, can I bring up the argument that I was...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You okay. So my argument is, or at least my question is, considering that Twitter, or the fighters' Twitters in particular, have become, in essence, an extension of the UFC's marketing strategy, because they use the fighters' Twitter handles as, you know, on their programming and as means of contacting the fighters, et cetera, et cetera. Should fighters be allowed to block consumers or, you know, fans? Because by blocking fans, they're now essentially removing a part of the potential market from the UFC's marketing strategy.
And the point I was bringing up is, I think the only time it's really appropriate for whether it be a fighter or anyone involved in it to be able to block someone is if they're being, let's say, harassed or stalked or something like that. But if you just don't like what someone has to say on Twitter or on Facebook, then you know what? That's part of being in the public spotlight. You chose to enter into this sport. That's a part of it. That's what comes with it. There's an obligation to the fans. There's an obligation to the people that are going to, you know, watch it, and to the company, and to other fighters. You have to know that.
You know what I think really has to be done? You know, like how when you go on a tech website, all the writers and all the bloggers have, Twitters and Facebook pages and stuff. You know, they don't expect... I'm sure they have their own personal pages as well. At this point, you know, fighters are really... A lot of them are used to the marketplace for mixed martial arts to be as being a lot smaller than it is now. And as it grows more and more popular, I don't think they're used to the same amount of fanfare.
Yeah, the effect.
Having, 50,000 plus followers. You know, so they're not totally sure of, you know, how to properly interact with that amount, or how to be a correct advocate of, you know, a multi-billion-dollar company.
Or representative.
Right, right, right. So, you know, maybe they should get into the practice of having a personal account and a professional account, you know.
See, I'm not so sure that would make a difference.
Yeah.
Here's why. When Miguel Torres makes his joke, or whatever the hell that was, he's going to do it to get out to the biggest number of people he possibly can, because he thinks, man, my fans are going to hear this because I think it's funny. And he's obviously going to have a lot more fans on his professional account than he would on his personal account.
Well, it's a lot easier to hold him liable if you define this is your professional, this is your Miguel Torres UFC account.
Right.
Well, let's even say, let's go into, you have your professional and you have your, you know, your personal, because I actually have, I have two different accounts set up for that specific reason.
Yeah,
and then I realized,
I do too.
I realized, all right, if you think about it, even if you make the comment, let's say Miguel Torres makes that comment on his personal account that's not representative of the company, you don't think the UFC is going to have a problem with that, or that it's not going to negatively represent
More importantly,
them?
In the world we live in right now with internet, how can I say this? With the internet and the way we've seen unflattering photos of actresses and things.
They're very flattering.
I was using unflattering more generally. The scary thing is that if you put information on the internet, someone's going to find it. And that's why I encourage, if any of you out there ever consider taking naked pictures of yourself, just don't.
Damn, too late.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it's scary. The internet is a scary place in the sense that once it's out there, it's written in pen and there's no internet whiteout.
What about erasable pen?
There is no erasable pen. I mean,
I used erasable pen all throughout middle school.
Well, not on the internet. There's no erasable pen. That's the scary part. You know, again, and this is just one of those things that I think is going to... It's an interesting development because it's kind of a product of our generation that doesn't really have rules yet. And as a result, we're going to kind of grow with it. So I'm weary. I'm weary of the way things are going to happen. I personally don't think you should block anyone. listen, you know, for those of us who run websites or do internet technology ventures, you have to kind of take the comments with a grain of salt and let them roll off your shoulder. If you're a fighter and someone says, and someone has a semi-intelligent, well-put-together sentence to say about you that is unflattering about the way you fight, okay, well, you have to just kind of take that.
Yeah,
if they say, F your mother, I'm going to come to your house and kill you, you know, that's different. That's all. And again, you know what's scary is that you have to make that you have to discern between those two things because there are two kinds of people. There are fans and there are trolls.
Yeah.
There are trolls who get off on your reaction to things. Again, the troll you can block. The fan who has an intelligent comment, I have a hard time saying, wow, this guy said something bad about me. I don't like it. But again, I'm not crazy. And as a result, I'm not, you know, a guy like, and again, not to call people crazy, but Chris Lieben's crazy. I mean, you know, there are people out there who are crazy. Those are the guys that worry me.
And to be honest, what I look at is, again, I'll keep saying this and I'll keep going back. Fighters are sensitive people.
Right.
Whether they freaking admit it or not, 90% of fighters are extremely sensitive. And this goes along to it. Maybe they want to block someone that says something negative about them because they don't want to have that and they can be fragile in the mind or whatever have you. I don't think that that's... I agree with you, both of you, that fighters shouldn't block... anybody unless they feel like they're being threatened in one way, shape, or form. You don't like it, don't, you know what, have someone handle the account for you.
Yeah,
you know,
BJ Penn.
Assistant. Yeah.
Yeah. Alright, that's going to be it for this week's episode of the Life of a Fighter podcast. As always, check out the website, lifeofafighter.com. James writes some excellent articles on there discussing the MMA world. Mike's always got stuff going on as far as his fights or other content. Always getting updated every single day, so make sure to check that out.
Right now we're back in a training camp, guys. I just want to let you all know. Going to have some good stuff coming up. So we got a grappling tournament in February, a fight in March.
Now, where is your grappling tournament in February?
That one's going to be in New Jersey. It's the New York Open.
Okay.
Invitational Open.
Which is funny because it's in New Jersey.
Yeah.
but yeah, so we're going to be following Mike on his journey through that. And always other good stuff going on. So until next week, Life of a Fighter podcast. Anthony DeFranco, James Dalton, Mike Kahlo. We'll talk to you next week.